Continue in our study on the topic of the principles of parenting. I'm well aware that this subject may not necessarily be of the greatest interest to some of you without kids. There's my clicker. There we go. And yet, as I have already mentioned in previous sermons, it's a subject you need to pay very great attention to. For several reasons. First of all of us have an effect on children. Maybe direct, maybe indirect, but you're going to have an effect. Some of you will be interacting with them directly and teaching them things like Awana or Sunday school, or you're watching kids for somebody. And then there's the indirect too, because kids are watching you. Whether you want them to or not, they are watching you, and you will have an influence on them. And when we consider that the current state of our nation is continuing to decline at a rapid pace, over one-third of all children are now born to single-parent homes in the United States. Over half will live in a single-parent home at some point during their upbringing. Now, that's not to disparage those who are in that situation and trying to raise their kids single-handedly. That's difficult. Some are doing a great job. We have some here that are really putting all the effort into it. But it's a job that was God's design for a mother and a father. So you're working from a deficit, and you need all the help you can get. And so when the body of Christ comes around and other adults are giving a good model for your kids, that is a great blessing both to you and to them. Your godly influence is needed in so many different places. That's not just to single parents, but also to those who do have both parents there. Because parenting's a tough job. Those who've been through it, amen, it is a tough job. Those in the middle of it, you're kind of wondering, when do I get to come up for air? And so when other adults are setting a godly example, that influence is so helpful. It is needed. In our society, we have seen it change to where it's generally become a very negative influence on families. The parenting philosophies advocated by our society are devastating in the effort to raise a godly and respectable offspring. Many of those who end up being or having rebellious children, it's because they didn't know what they're supposed to be doing. They were following the ways of society. And then those who have rebellious children often come up, they become complainers who discourage the parents who are parenting, and often even young couples, newlyweds, why would you even bother to have kids? I recall when Jonathan was born, I had someone comment to me that, oh, he's so cute now. Too bad in 18 years he's going to be a rebellious teenager. How do you know what he's going to be in 18 years? They just thought that was normal. When Jonathan was 2 and David was born, we received all sorts of unsolicited comments about how bad the 2-year-olds were and how terrible this is going to be for you trying to raise an infant with a 2-year-old. One woman even told Diane that she would not have children again if she could do it over again. Frankly, we felt sorry for her children to grow up with such a callous, selfish, insensitive mother. No wonder they developed so many problems as they grew up. Then we were expecting Jimmy 2 years later, so that means a 4-year-old, a 2-year-old, and now an infant. We had people question our sanity. Those of you with more kids, I'm sure you have even more stories of such things. You know, Psalm 127, verses 3 through 5, are very clear that children are a gift of the Lord. And then it goes on and says that how blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. And I know there usually is this discussion, how many in a quiver? However many you got, that's your quiver. But they're a blessing. At least they're supposed to be. So why then do some people have such scorn for parenting and consider children a curse? Well, it goes back to the basis to their parenting philosophy and practices that fostered children who became brats, then rebellious when adolescents, and then curses on society when they became adults. If you walk in the counsel of the ungodly, do not be surprised when ungodliness shows up. That is what you've been teaching them. That is the fruit. And so we need to be diligent to get godly counsel and to follow it. That is a great need for all parents, single or couples. And so all of you, parents, non-parents alike, we actually do this somewhat together. We need the encouragement. We need to encourage you. as we strive to raise godly offspring and help one another in that process. What has happened to our society? Let me give you a very quick thumbnail sketch. 18th century philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau sowed the seeds of what we are seeing today in parenting. Now, Rousseau was gifted in words, but he definitely was not gifted in virtue. He had no love for children. All five of his children, born to his mistress, he did not marry her, they were taken at birth and disposed in a hospital for infants. It really was a death mill. It received about 3,000 abandoned infants per year. Two out of every three children put there died within the first year. Of any given year of 3,000, 14 would make it to maturity. Rousseau did not name any of his children. He did not record the dates of their birth. He didn't even bother to find out if it was a boy or a girl. Now, years later, the deist Voltaire publicly condemned Rousseau for his acts of really practical infanticide. And in defense to this criticism, Rousseau put forth a view. He said, quote, "Instead of being evil by nature, man is born originally good, not naturally capable of evil thoughts or acts." He went on to explain that children, quote, "remained righteous and innocent until contaminated by traditions and beliefs of adults. Parents and teachers, not nature, direct the child toward evil tendencies," unquote. Therefore, he argued that children were better off being raised by the state than parents. Now, Rousseau's arguments were fallacious and without justification for his actions. But this idea of children being born good and then corrupted by parents took root. Henry David Thoreau, he brought this idea to America by teaching that each child is born in nature and should be encouraged to continue in living a free, uncommitted life reflective of nature. Thoreau taught that the natural way was good and beneficial, and that parents who try to alter the natural way of a child will corrupt the child. You see how this builds and where it's going. Arnold Giselle, founder of the Yale Clinic of Child Development, he expanded on these thoughts, saying that a child was naughty because his or her natural goodness was perverted by a restrictive and what he called an undemocratic environment. So the environment was messing the kid up. And so he advocated giving children unlimited freedom of expression, equality, and parental friendship. And that is an idea that's very strong in our society, that we're trying to be friends with our kids. Rudolf, I think it's Dreikers, added to this humanistic idea that the absence of equality fosters innate feelings of inferiority within the child, resulting in naughty behavior as a child attempts to become equal or superior. He believed that every child has, quote, "the right to decide for oneself, to be self-determining, to refuse to submit to coercion and domination by others," unquote. That would include parents, teachers, and authorities. His damaging influence increased because he provided a structured program for training parents and teachers in his philosophy. Programs such as active parenting, parent effectiveness training, and systematic training and effective parenting all stem from this or similar ideas. Psychiatrists such as B.F. Skinner, Sigmund Freud, Eric Erickson added to this. Skinner was a behaviorist psychiatrist, and he viewed man as just an animal, one that just responds to his environment. Therefore, he advocated the removal of all boundaries to avoid conflict. And if you could not remove them, at least manipulate them, because conflict is negative and therefore should be avoided. Freud said that early childhood is the source of adult emotional problems, and then developed the idea that the unconscious controls your behavior. Erickson divided the life of man into eight stages according to these ideas, eight major developmental problems. Infancy, he said, was where the issues were trust versus mistrust, a toddler, autonomy versus shame or doubt. Preschool was initiative versus guilt. School age was industry industry versus inferiority, and adolescence, identity versus role confusion, and he went on. Now, few people actually read the writings of these men. It's those who read the writings and then popularize it, is how it gets into society. And their ideas have become widespread by that, and they have radically changed the general philosophy of parenting within America over the last 100 years, especially in the last 50 years. They're advocated in popular parenting and children's magazines. The so-called experts, they write about it in newspaper, magazine columns. The shelves of bookstores are full of their writings, of those who tout their particular version of these philosophies and practices. The general model now includes these ideas that man's nature is innately good, or at worst, neutral, that parental authority is bad and so is replaced by parental suggestions and family democracy, that restrictions are harmful, so children are given freedom of expression with little or no restraint, that conflict is bad, so conflict avoidance is good, that unfilled desire is detrimental, so children are given immediate gratification from birth. Now, it's no surprise, then, that children raised in these kinds of philosophies and the practices that come out of them end up becoming proud, selfish adults who lack the skills to live respectable lives and be blessings to others. And we all run into them all the time. Employers are having a horrible time trying to find employees that actually show up on time and do the job. Because what have they been trained in? Now, all these things are opposite of godly wisdom. And so there's quite a contrast. They are opposites. Man is not innately good. Man is innately sinful. He's foolish, as I pointed out from Proverbs 22:15 in the previous sermons. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of discipline will remove it far from him. Both parental authority and restriction are not only good, they are necessary in order to keep the foolish bent of the child from harming himself and others. If you do not put a restriction, they will harm themselves. Why do you think you have to tell children not to touch the stove and slap their hand to train them don't do it? Because they'll grab it. And a slap doesn't hurt nearly as much as when they end up with second-degree burns or worse because they've grabbed a hot item. Proverbs 23, 13, and 14 even escalates this, speaking of the necessity of parental discipline in delivering the soul of the child from Sheol, that is, death. Deferred gratification is necessary to teach self-control, and any worthwhile skills or achievements are dependent upon self-control, deferred gratification. Everything from potty training and coloring between the lines to earning a degree or winning an Olympic medal depends on self-control. If you don't have it, you won't achieve it. Proverbs 25, 28 warns that a man who has no control over his spirit is like a city that is broken into without walls. Anything can come in. It is a characteristic of a godly man to be self-controlled, Titus 1:8. It's a requirement for elders. It's also one of the fruit of the Spirit, Galatians 5:23. Conflict, well, it's the normal course of living in a sin-cursed world, isn't it? We are going to have conflict. So conflict resolution is good. Conflict avoidance leads to either manipulation or self-induced oppression. And God himself set the example for this, because God set the example of resolving man's greatest conflict, which is sin itself, isn't it? And that is why he sent Jesus Christ to remove the barrier so that we can be have the sin problem resolved, because it's paid for. And by placing our faith in him, we are adopted into his family, we are saved. We have a relationship with God again. It's a resolving of conflict, not avoiding it. So parenting starts, as we said last week, from the negative position. Our children come to us sinful and foolish, right? I wish they came wonderful kids, only goodness in their heart, but they don't come that way. We start from a deficit. And so God has given to parents the responsibility to train their children to overcome that innate foolishness to become wise adults. How? By loving God themselves and then being diligent to teach their children about God and his commands in all the common situations of life. We discussed that from Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9. We are to bring them up in the discipline and the nurture of the Lord, as Ephesians 6, 4 puts it. So the goal of the Christian parent then is laying this foundation for their children, both laying a foundation that their child may come to understand who Christ is, repent, and become a Christian themselves, but also laying a foundation by which they're going to become adults with godly character, even if they don't become Christians. We want them to understand the truth, to live by it, and only God is going to tell us how the world actually works. So that's the goal of every parent, really, is to raise respectable children of high character, those of high virtue, those who are going to be responsible adults. They're going to be a blessing to other people, not a curse. Now, we need then to raise our children in this society in such a way that they're going to be able to stand firm and walk in righteousness, maybe even alone in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, because that's what they're entering. And we all know it. We're all experiencing it ourselves all the time. And our kids, they're getting swamped with it. They have more means of this junk coming in on them than we imagined could even exist when we were kids. It is our responsibility to train them to stand firm in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. And so that's why we're spending extra time on this subject. There are principles that God has given us for raising our children. Now, I could take this topic and approach it several different ways, but I've personally chosen to deal with it in terms of responsibility. Responsibility. Why? Because God has given us responsibility, and we need to fulfill those things, both for our own sake, but also for our children's sake. If we do not, and our children are affected by this society and go that the natural bent they have anyways in foolishness, they will suffer greatly. We have a responsibility ourselves. We got a responsibility we need to teach them. And as we teach them to become responsible, they can start standing firm against all these things. So I'm going to phrase all these things in terms of responsibility. Things you need to do yourself, things you need to teach your children. He's placed children with a responsibility to learn and apply the lessons they learn from their parents. Okay? So everybody's got responsibility. Now, we've already covered responsibility to God, and we started on the first part of responsibility to family, which is the duty to parents. And this morning, we're going to continue to complete about that topic. That's as far as we're going to get today. In the future, we're going to take on other responsibilities in the family, responsibility that we have to siblings, other family members, the extended family. We're going to deal with responsibilities to a society, which includes authorities, peers, just the other people in society, the masses, and then responsibilities towards property and nature. That's where we're going to go in the future. Now, in terms of responsibility to God, we again go back to the principles of Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9. We are to love God ourselves, and then we are to diligently teach our children about God and His commandments in all the situations of life. When you rise up, when you sit down, when you walk by the way, when you're sitting in your house. Every situation should be something you can be pointing toward God or His commands that concern how we're to behave, what we're supposed to do, what He's done. Proverbs chapter 3, verses 1 through 12, actually succinctly describes what a godly parent should be doing in teaching their children about God and His commandments. And in this section, it's a father instructing his son. So picking up Proverbs 3, verse 1, "My son, do not forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments. For length of days and years of life and peace they will add to you. Do not let kindness and truth leave you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. And so you will find favor and good repute in the sight of God and man. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will make your path straight. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn away from evil. It will be healing to your body and refreshment to your bones. Honor the Lord from your wealth and from the first of all your produce. So your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine. My son, do not reject the discipline of the Lord or loathe His reproof. For whom the Lord loves, He reproves, even as a father and the son in whom He delights." And of course, Proverbs is filled with all sorts of things, very practical things about what we're to be doing in raising our children, the things we're to be teaching them, how God wants us to behave, what God is like. Now, in terms of family responsibilities, the first responsibility of parents within the family is to fulfill their God-given role as a husband or a wife. That's number one, and we spent time on that a week or two ago. The first family responsibility toward children is teaching them to obey. Ephesians 6:1 says that directly. Children, obey your parents. But it comes out of Exodus 20:12, the fifth commandment. Honor your mother and father. And it is the first command with a promise, isn't it? That it may be well with you and you'll live long in the land. As I explained last week, when we talk about obedience, it means you obey the first time, or children obey the first time. They obey right away, and they obey with a happy face. You're going to be working on the attitude, but at least got to get the outside thing on there first. So at least with a happy face, while you keep working on the attitude, so it actually is expressive of what's inside. But that's what we mean by obedience. And it's a very serious matter, because if we fail to teach our children to obey in that manner, we are ending up teaching them to disobey, and they will incur the wrath of God. And that's not what we want for our kids. We want God's blessing on them, so we need to teach them how to gain that. Now, Proverbs is full of statements calling on children to obey the parents. In fact, I looked up just the term, my son. 31 Proverbs have that phrase, in which it's either directly addressed to admonish or maybe give advice or on a warning. Hear your father's instruction. Receive my sayings. Accept my sayings. Give attention to my words. Give attention to my wisdom. Observe the commandments. Keep my words. Listen, be wise. And then there were some negative ones. Do not forget. Do not reject. Do not depart from. What kinds of things? My teachings, my sayings, the discipline of the Lord. And on it goes. So Proverbs is full of all sorts of things to help you teach your children this principle. The wise and godly child is going to be an obedient child. Now I want to expand on that issue. Now Ephesians 6:1 again states, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. And it then quotes from Exodus 20:12, honor your father and mother, that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. That's the first commandment with a promise. Now, obedience then is the first responsibility of children toward their parents as part of honoring them. And that's where we're going to focus on. The obedience is coming because it's how you honor your parents. It's how you honor God. But honor goes beyond obedience. Obedience is focused on the action of complying to instructions and commands. Honor encompasses both proper actions of deference and showing courteous regard to parents, but it also includes a proper attitude of respect. That's what should be behind it. Now, the particular ways in which honor is shown is going to vary from culture to culture, but the respectful attitude is really the same in all cultures. There is to be a respect. It's simply a matter of variation in how that is demonstrated. But that's what is there for. We demonstrate respect by honoring, actions of honor. Now, that's not to say it's always easy to have a respectful attitude. Sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes it's difficult to even go through the actions that display honor. And yet, it is what the Lord requires. Following the Lord's commands, as we already saw in Proverbs 3, brings his blessing. But he also gives very stern warnings of what happens if we don't. For example, Exodus 21:15 and 17 and Matthew 15:4 both talk about it ending up actually in death, to dishonor in this manner. Proverbs 20, verse 20 states, he who curses his father and mother, his lamp will go out in time of darkness. Proverbs 30, verse 17 adds, the eye that mocks a father and scorns a mother, the ravens of the valley will pick it out and the young eagles will eat it. Ugh. But what is it talking about there? Dead, and the scavengers are eating the body. They don't even get a decent burial. So it's a serious matter. Now, for many of us, this idea of honoring our parents, of obeying them, it's not hard. We had loving parents. They were respectful people. And so it's actually a joy to do so. I thank God that that's true with my parents. It's a joy for me to honor them. We like to be with them. And so it's not hard to show high regard for them. But that's not true for all of you here. For some of you, this is very difficult. Your parents were not loving. They were not respectable. In fact, they may have even been abusive, neglectful, or absent. For you, honoring your parents is a joyless duty done simply because God requires it because of their position, not their character. That's difficult. That's hard. And though a godly man despises a reprobate, according to Psalm 15:4, yet you're still to show them honor because they have the position that they're your parents. It really becomes that simple. Well, how is that done, and what does that have to do with raising your children? Well, first remember that your example will greatly influence your kids. In some ways, your example is going to have more influence than whatever your words are. Second, by understanding what you need to do in honoring your parents, you also learn what you need to do in teaching your children to honor you. In my discussion of honoring parents, I'm going to be intertwining three different areas. First, you honoring your parents. Second, you teaching your children to honor you. And then third, teaching your children to honor grandparents and older adults as well, because they all tie in together. So how do you honor parents? Well, it begins with how you speak to them. That seems simple enough, doesn't it? But it's one that it's a simple area that our society is losing. How do you speak to them? That includes not only what you say, but the manner in which you say it. You start by addressing them and referring to them by whatever terms show respect in your culture or subculture. It could be a formal title. I know in some culture it is. They actually refer to their parents with formal titles. It could be terms of endearment, you know, mom, dad, papa, mama, something like that, whatever that is. But it's a title that has respect with it. Terms like the old man and the old lady are not respectful, okay? They are not. They're disrespectful. Be respectful in your speech to them and your speech about them when you're talking to others. This includes the tone of voice you use. Now, it should be obvious, do not yell at them. Don't call them names. Don't curse them, even though that's increasingly common within our society. You can find it out in supermarkets now. You have some kid who's cursing out their mother because they didn't get a piece of candy at the checkout line. Yes, such a child is a shame to the mother. Neither should your parents be the butt of your jokes. And sarcasm against them is always inappropriate. There are a host of scriptures that address this topic of speech and accompanying attitudes. In fact, there's going to be one sermon that's going to be just talking about the tongue. All of it's going to apply to what you're doing with your kids and how you're raising them. But Proverbs 10:31 gives a good summary. The mouth of the righteous flows wisdom. Those who are wise, you've been raising the way we're talking about in Proverbs, it's going to flow with wisdom. But the perverted tongue will be cut out. See, at minimum, we apply Ephesians 4:29. Nothing unwholesome, nothing derogatory, nothing gross, crass, nothing of that nature should ever come out of your mouth. And you should speak the truth in love with a graciousness that is designed to build the other person up according to the need of the moment. It's Ephesians 4:15, 29, and Colossians 4:6. Proverbs 21:23 admonishes, "He who guards his mouth and his tongue guards his soul from troubles." How often have we opened your mouth? How often have you opened your mouth and you found it brought you all sorts of trouble? All of us. James says, "He who controls his tongue is a perfect man." There ain't nobody perfect here. If you are perfect, you're in the wrong place, okay? You're among the wrong people, because we're not. But you can see the wisdom here. As we learn to do this, we do guard our souls. So teach your children early. How do they speak? How do you allow them to speak to you? So do not allow your children to speak to you disrespectfully, not in word, not in tone. Do not allow them to use inappropriate words or names or curse or swear. Do not allow them to yell or scream or sass or talk back to you, because defiance in words and tone is disrespectful, and it will lead to disobedience in action. It will escalate. Require them to speak clearly with appropriate words and appropriate voice and tone. And you keep practicing till they get it down. Now, there is one caution here. As you are doing your parenting and trying to help them learn these things, is be careful of provoking the anger, as Ephesians 6:4 warns, or exasperating them, as Colossians 3:21 warns. Parental decisions that seem arbitrary, contradictory, or oblivious to the thoughts and feelings of the child certainly can cause that. You can provoke your child to anger. You can exasperate them. Well, what then can be done so that children can be respectful even when a parent's commands are exasperating and are provoking to them? Because the child still has to be respectful, even if you haven't thought about it and are being not a very good parent at that moment. Well, a solution to this is set up an appeal system so that when there's a legitimate reason, the child can ask a parent to reconsider the command. How does this work? It means the child respectfully requests the parent to hear some more information. We use this in our family, and we actually use the term, "May I appeal? I am requesting." Now, if the child is disrespectful in how they are seeking this appeal, it's automatically null and void. There is no appeal. Too bad. Why? Because respect is required. But the child's respectful, asked to appeal. Now the parent says yes, and the child can give more information that can help the parent make a better decision. That's the whole purpose of it. So the child can be respectful and give the information the parent needs so that they're not provoking the child to anger or exasperating them. All right? It's a very simple process, but it's respectful. Not allowing your child to sass you and talk back to you is important. Here's a means by which they can get without what they need to say in a respectful manner and not be usurping your position as parent and not being disrespectful, which puts them in danger with God's wrath. Now, adult children who are on their own certainly do not have an obligation to obey their parents any longer. You're on your own. You're responsible for yourself. But you do still need to respect your parents. You may not want their advice. You may not like their advice. But you need to listen to it graciously anyways. And who knows? You may still learn something. Okay? And even when you have a disagreement with your parents, you're still to be respectful, because you can discuss matters, present your arguments without being disagreeable or fighting. One of the things that should happen in a family is you learn how to resolve conflict. That means you learn how to fight fairly. And how they're going to do that? By watching the adults. So if you're yelling and screaming, guess what you're teaching your kids? If you can go through and calmly work back and forth until for the resolution, what are you teaching your kids? That's what we want to teach them. Now, if you have not been taught that, you're going to have to learn it the hard way. You've got to stop now. Don't get into being obnoxious. But you say, but my parents are obnoxious. What then? Well, that could be true. You don't have to follow their lead, all right? You do not have to join them in being a reprobate. Proverbs 15:1 says, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. So what are you going to do? You want to calm the situation down, or you want to stir it up more? So Proverbs has a lot of things about that. If they are becoming obnoxious to the point that you can't handle it, simply graciously excuse yourself and leave. The tragedy of parents that are obnoxious of that manner is they estrange their adult children to the point they only receive the minimum honor due them, because they destroy the closeness that should be in the relationship. And that's a tragedy going both ways. And it's very common now. Children who are estranged from their parents. There is no more discussion. There's just very minimal contact. But it doesn't have to be that way. We are to be respectful to our parents in speech and tone. We're to show them honor by actions that demonstrate respect for their position. Now, the specific ways in which that is done is going to vary from culture to culture. I'm just going to give you a few things that are common in general U.S. culture, or should say maybe they used to be common in general U.S. culture, or they may not be so common anymore, but they are ways that demonstrate respect. They're actions of honoring a person because of their position. Now, these honors are generally given from oldest to youngest, because you may have a bunch of people there. You generally start with the oldest and you work your way down. But let's start with this. Number one, give an appropriate greeting. It doesn't necessarily have to be a formal greeting. And a formal greeting would be that when the person walks in the room, you actually are supposed to stand up and greet them. That's a formal greeting. Or if you walk into the room, you walk over to them and greet them. That's formal. That actually was very common, and actually it's actually built on a principle given in Leviticus 19:32 that you are to rise when the aged walk in, the hoary head, the gray-haired. Hey, I think I got that now. Why, when I walk in, you should rise. But it's a sign of honor, and that's where it came from. And that became a general practice in Western civilization of showing honor to those who are aged. Now, it may not be that way. I don't know what the subculture is that you're in that's that formal. But it needs to be at least a greeting by name. You know, hello, mom, hi, dad, something. Not a ignoring them or grunting.
Yeah.
What is that? That is not respectful. It's not honoring. It's disrespectful. It's dishonoring. All right? So it starts with something as simple as a greeting. Don't be rude. A tip for those of you who wear hats. It's appropriate to take off your hat or at least tip it when you greet somebody. Okay? Yes, we know that JP loves hats. Now you know what to do with them, right? Okay. It's becoming a lost art. People don't even think about it anymore. But actually, that is proper. That is a way of showing honor. It's a simple thing, but it's a way of showing honor to somebody, of respecting them. Now, I would also advocate for parents, teach your children by both your example and role play it. Okay? Set up a game with it. Have them come in. You know, how would we do this? Have you taught your children how to give a formal introduction? Mom, dad, this is so-and-so. So-and-so, this is my mom and dad. You know, have you taught them that? How to give a formal introduction? That's your responsibility. If you don't do it, they're not going to know what to do. And that's why you have people go to somebody's house and you have a hostess and the guests come in, they stand there, they look at each other. They're kind of waiting for an introduction. And finally they get tired of it and they say, well, let me introduce myself. Well, it's a simple thing, but guess what? If you're the host or hostess, it's a way that you show honor to your guests. Do you see how respect starts spreading out everywhere? Common courtesies, common manners, really all them end up focusing on this aspect. It's about being gracious and showing respect and giving honor rather than being selfish. I just want to do what I want. Let me quickly add one other thing. Not only do not let your children be disrespectful to you, do not let them be that way to you. Do not let their friends be disrespectful to you. Okay? That just reinforces it. If they're ignorant, teach them. If they should know better, then give them an appropriate rebuke. Do not allow it. Otherwise, you're simply reinforcing their sin. Okay, so that's one. Just starting with greetings. Okay, another thing. Offer parents, and I'm going to throw in here grandparents. Again, you start with whoever's the oldest. Offer them the better place to sit. That includes your seat. That could be done wherever you are. It could be in your home. It could be the car, the bus, a train, a restaurant, wherever it is, you offer them the better seat. Now, they can decline it, but you offer to them. That shows respect. That shows honor. Teach that to your children, again, by your example toward your parents and the instruction you give them of what you expect from them. Another one, if food is being served or something else is being served, it is offered to the parents or other adults first. Again, you start with the oldest and you work your way down. If it's a buffet line, yes, you can now say that, right? If it's a buffet line, who goes first? The oldest goes first. Or someone will go and get it for them and bring it back to them, because sometimes they're not up to standing in lines or serving themselves. Someone will do it for them. But our society has become so child-centered, it's common to see young children and their parents demanding they get served first with the excuse, well, they can't wait. They're just kids. They can wait. They will not die. Honest, they're not going to die. They're not even going to get sick. Now, I do realize there are some medical conditions where children have to eat kind of on a schedule. Guess whose responsibility that one is? The parents, to make sure they got a snack with them. They might have diabetes or hypoglycemia or something like that, to have something with them to hold them until it is their turn. Okay? Because it is about showing honor and respect. Be self-effacing, considering others as more important than yourself, moving you away from your selfish bent to considering others as more important. So that's another one. Reduce your child's innate selfishness. Teach them to wait respectfully for those who are older to go first. Now, the same principle actually applies to any line that you're in. Your parents are offered the front, or at least that part of the line that you have some control over. You and your children then come after that. And that's where you're getting on you're queued up for a bus, a train, you're getting in a room or getting out of a room or a building, or whatever it is. Now, I realize there can be a safety issue here, and parents generally do not like their children standing in back of them where they can't see them. And there are places where there's a safety issue. Where there's a safety issue, sandwich your children. One adult in front, one adult in back, or at least the oldest child in front and the oldest and an adult in back, so you can watch them and keep them safe. I'm not saying remove that, but teach them respect. You allow them in first. The same thing is like, opening the door for somebody. We taught our children to do that. We even taught our children to do that for, in the car. Diane's very patient. She waits there in the front seat until one of them will run around and open the door for her. You go into a building. You open the door for the ladies. We also open the door for older people. Yes, guys, I know. It is the age of feminism. You might get hit with a handbag if you open the door for a woman. So if she hits you with a handbag, she is no lady. Do it anyways, okay? You're tough. You can take it. All right? In group conversation, where there's a bunch of adults around, and there might be kids in there too, seek out the wisdom of those who are older. Seek them out. In Job 12:12, Job said, "Wisdom is with aged men, with a long life is understanding." That's an axiomatic truth. The longer you live, you do learn something. You may have learned it by the school of hard knocks, but you have learned something. In Job 32:7, we find that Elihu waited until the older men had completely exhausted themselves speaking before he even entered the conversation. And he wasn't a spring chicken, but he was not nearly as old as these other guys. Now, I like kids. I like to talk with kids. But that doesn't mean I want a child to enter into adult conversation and think they're a peer. Because when that happens, it feeds the pride of the child, and they become wise in their own eyes. In contrast to what we saw in Proverbs 3, do not be wise in your own eyes. Teach your children the lost art of listening. Listening. Certainly, they are to speak if they are spoken to. Do anything less than that is rude. But they should refrain from offering their thoughts and opinions in such a setting. They can talk it over with you later. Learn to listen. There is a reason God gave you two ears and one mouth, right? Now, I also realize that as people get older, that hearing problems can develop that make it very difficult for them to participate. An even greater reason to be proactive in showing them respect and bring them into the conversation. Yes, it can be difficult. I recall growing up, my grandfather was very hard of hearing. And when family gatherings were around, he was usually two or three subjects behind in the conversation. Some of you may have had similar experiences. They caught something and they've been thinking about it, and finally, oh, okay, so they jump in, but the conversation's moved on. Now, it would be very easy to ignore such a person. It would be easy for us to ignore our grandfather. But I always found that if you paid attention to what he said, even it now changed the conversation back to an earlier subject, he always had some interesting story or thought that was worth hearing. And I greatly enjoyed that growing up, of hearing his stories. You know, especially he was interested in mechanics. He actually drove a Stanley steamer, brand new. His brother-in-law was actually a silent film star, so he got to do all sorts of things that were among the elite, and he had these interesting stories. Or how he kept trying to get to World War I and kept getting blocked. And he tried the Navy, and he tried the Army, he tried something. Finally got someone to induct him, and he's on his train heading to the East Coast to get on a boat to go to France, and the war ends. So he's volunteering, I'll go over. I mean, he's got all sorts of interesting stories. But those are lost if you don't pay attention. Pay attention to them. Seek them out, include them in. It's a sign of respect and honor. Another thing that can be done. Remember and acknowledge days, and here's a clue here, an important one, that are important to them. Okay? To them. It could be birthday, a holiday, an anniversary of some sort. It could be an anniversary of something that was important to them. The general holidays, Mother's Day, Father's Day, whatever it is. If it's important to them, make sure you remember it and acknowledge it somehow. It could be with a visit, a phone call, a card. And you can include your children in that, because even a young child can scribble some sort of picture and you include it in the card with them. That's teaching your children to honor. Do you see how it keeps working here? I'm trying to develop an attitude within my children. Through all these actions, I'm working to develop an attitude in them of respect and honor, of putting myself second and others first. That ends up having effect all up and down the line in their life. Another one that is necessary is provide for their real needs. 1 Timothy 5 specifically states this. 1 Timothy 5:8, it says, if anyone does not provide for his own, especially those of his own household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. And the context then goes on about the treatment of widows and what is a widow indeed and what is not. So the context here is talking about the extended family. Honoring your parents includes caring for them and their real needs. For good parents, that can be done with joy, even if it's a great sacrifice for you. You want to do it. You enjoy doing it. You're glad, glad to do it. But if you had irresponsible parents, well, this becomes a very depressing duty, a very difficult, depressing duty. So let me quickly expand on this a bit, especially if you have parents that have been irresponsible. One, you do not have to cater to their whims nor support them in a standard of living that you cannot afford. Okay? That's not required here. That's not what 1 Timothy is talking about. It's providing for their real needs. You do not need to subsidize their irresponsibility. Your minimum obligation is making sure they have some means of survival with food, clothing, and shelter. That's the provision that's being talked about. If they refuse what you offer, then they continue on their own until they will accept what you can offer. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, a couple things. One, do not give money to alcoholics, addicts, or spendthrifts, all right? You don't have it to waste. That violates all the principles we're going to find in Proverbs dealing with finances. You meet the actual needs through tangible necessities. If they need food, you go get good food for them and bring it over. If you got to cook it, you do that too. Do not give them the money. They'll waste it. An alcoholic's going to buy what? Some kind of drink. An addict's going to spend it on whatever he's addicted to. A spendthrift is just going to blow it on who knows what. But it's not going to go to what their real need is. So that means more involvement. You might not be in a position to do a whole lot, but let's say you have an extra room in your house and you offer it. You can come live with us. You can't pay their bills. This is what you can do. What if they turn down the offer? Your obligation has ceased. Just make sure the offer's still on the table. When you need it, we'll find a way you can come live with us, because there I can take care of your food and shelter and your clothing. But I don't have funds to be sending you to keep you where you're at. So you do what you can. Now, if you have the extra funds and you can do that, I mean, that's fine. That's up to you. But your obligation is really minimum to make sure that they have a means for survival. They can have food, clothing, and shelter. Beyond that is graciousness. And hopefully you are gracious. And again, if you had good parents, you want to do that and you will sacrifice. If they're irresponsible, it may just be the minimum, but you still need to do the minimum with a respectful attitude. That can be the harder part. But it's still needed. That's still an obligation that God has placed upon you. So again, if they refuse what you can offer, your obligation's met, just make sure the offer remains on the table. It's still there for them. When they need it, it's there. Perhaps you're in a position you can arrange for their care, but they refuse it. Well, again, all you can do, leave the offer on the table. They may reconsider it and take you up on it later. Remember, your children are watching you. How you honor your parents is what you're teaching them for how they will honor you. Right? So you want to be a godly parent that is teaching your children to be respectful. And you want to be such a godly parent that when it comes to your children honoring you, they're going to be able to do it out of joy and not out of duty.